The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. Justices Hecht and O'Neill are not able to be here this morning due to weather problems and minor illness, but they will both participate in the deliberation and decision of these cases. We have two cases on the oral submission docket. They are David Williams and Tarrant County versus Ruth Murray, Marie Lara, and Michael Huff in Tarrant County, and Ernesto and Maria Resendez versus Ron Johnson and Chad Woolery from Dallas County. In each of these matters, the court is allotted 20 minutes for petitioners to present oral argument and for respondents, and the petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk's office, and you may purchase a tape of either argument for a nominal fee. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Williams versus Lara.
May it please the court. Ms. LaRoe will present arguments for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 10 minutes for a vote.
Good morning. May it please the court. Opposing counsel, my name is Christy LaRoe. Mr. Russ Freemel and I are privileged to appear before you for Tarrant County, Texas, and for David Williams in his official capacity as sheriff of our county. Tarrant County has allowed community volunteers to operate a faith-based unit in our county jail facility. With respect to this unit, inmates volunteer apply to live in a segregated unit and undertake an intensive study of Christianity and Christian values. The petitions for review in this case raise several novel issues. First, in general, are faith-based prison rehabilitation programs constitutional? What is the standard to be applied in assessing the constitutionality of such programs? And finally, who has standing to challenge them? Tarrant County believes that the Court of Appeals erred when it determined that two plaintiffs in this case, Ruth Marie Lara and Michael Huff, two former inmates of the Tarrant County Jail, have standing to enjoin operation of the CEU.
Ms. Lara, can you tell me, describe for me, what dollars are spent in connection with this program?
With respect to the program, Your Honor, no dollars are spent. The same amount of money that would be spent without operation of the program is spent in operation of the jail.
But aren't salaried employees of the county actually participating in running the program and making decisions associated with the program?
No, ma'am. The program is operated and overseen on a daily basis by community volunteers. A volunteer chaplain compiles the academic content of the courses and handles any day-to-day problems, and community volunteers do the actual teaching. The only time a county employee may get involved is if there's a correctional-based problem that arises with the program.
Well, isn't there deposition testimony that was submitted in connection with the summary judgment motions that indicated that the sheriff and one other person employed by the county, in fact, were making the decisions associated with the curriculum for the program and what could and would be taught and how the program was to be run from the religious education perspective?
The academic or religious content of the program has been set since before this sheriff was in office.
I understand, but isn't there deposition testimony reflecting that the sheriff and at least one other paid employee are involved in making decisions on an ongoing basis? For example, if there were to be a change in the curriculum, didn't the sheriff testify that he would have to approve it?
Yes, that's correct. One way of looking at that deposition testimony, in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs in this case, would be that the chaplain, who was the paid employee I believe that you are referring to, and the sheriff would have the right to veto content in the unit.
As an example, they're not going to permit them to be teaching inmates how to break out of jail.
Correct. Any religious philosophy, or any philosophy, religious or not, that is anathema to the correctional goals, that is adverse to security, that has been shown or is feared to cause disruption among the inmates, would not be allowed.
Could the city hall, the commissioner's court, let's say in the county building, set up a church in their office building to operate on a regular basis and restrict the church to identifying the religious tenets of the church as being a factor in determining which church will be allowed to set up operations on the city in the county building?
Justice Enoch, can I ask you, are you asking me about access to county facilities? Are you asking me whether the county would
No,
infect?
Not access. I mean, this is not a question of whether they make their facilities open to all people. I'm asking about setting up a church on the facilities. Could the county set up a church on the facilities, assuming that no county employees conduct the services, no county employees provide the educational programming, but they just determine we're going to set up a church?
Well, respectfully, I would suggest that if those were the facts, that the county would not be setting up a church.
Could they set up a organization on the campus, on the county facility? Could they set up an organization that's kind of, I guess, superimposed on the business operations that would be set aside for religious education? And religious education. Could they just say, we're going to set up a CYZ group
program
here, and you all come in and run it on our premises?
They certainly could set up such a program, and it's likely that this court would apply a standard of review that is a more strict standard of review than the standard we're arguing in this case. In this case, because we are talking about a penal institution, we suggest respectfully that there should be a more deferential standard of review applied to judge the governmental decision in this case. The Supreme Court has noted that prisons face intractable administrative problems. And in 1987, the Supreme Court articulated a general standard of review to be applied to all constitutional questions that arise in a penal setting.
Has it ever been applied to the Establishment Clause?
No, the Supreme Court has not had the opportunity or chosen to take the opportunity to articulate a standard for the Establishment Clause claims brought within the context of a penal setting. So there is no Supreme Court decision one way or the other.
What are the arguments that we should apply it in an Establishment Clause case, the standard set out in that case?
The standard that should be applied is, does the governmental action being challenged, in this case, Tarrant County's decision to allow community volunteers to come in and operate this religious education unit, does Tarrant County have legitimate penological interest, and is operation of that unit reasonably related to those interests? And I would suggest that Tarrant County does have a legitimate interest in faith-based prison programs. In fact, faith-based prison programs are uniquely suited to achieve both Tarrant County's penological goals and society's goals in incarcerating people.
Could the sheriff agree to with an organization Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses or a Jewish community to provide the faith-based programming with a view toward converting these prisoners to their faith so they will be better persons when they are released from the jail and be more cooperative citizens in society?
If the sheriff can articulate a legitimate penological interest in doing so, and the evidence...
Then the sheriff could agree with an organization
that has determined that to make them a better citizen of society, it's an important tenet that they be converted to that particular religion?
I think that in that case, the court may have difficulty with the part of the test that asks whether that decision by the sheriff is reasonably related to legitimate penological goals.
So your answer is yes, that even if the organization's tenet is that they are conversion to their religion is a critical element, even if that's the case, if the sheriff can show that in fact is true, they become better citizens by becoming Christians, then the sheriff can set up this kind of program in the jail.
The answer is that it would still be subject to review, but I believe that the deferential standard is the appropriate standard. However, that's not the case in this case. In this case, the sheriff is not mandating that anyone participate. At the end of the day, the most we can say about the Establishment Clause is that it prohibits governmental conduct. And what we have in this case is we have private conduct by the volunteers, and private conduct by the inmates who choose to enter into this program. And what we
but
have...
But isn't it all permitted by a governmental agency that oversees the curricula and how it's carried out, etc.?
Yes, Your Honor.
In other words, an entanglement situation.
For our own legitimate penological interests, we have allowed...
Well, if I understand, you're advocating that even though Turner's never been applied to the Establishment Clause, that we should do that in this case. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Is it a correct statement that you only look at whether there is a valid secular purpose when you apply Turner, and that's as far as you go?
No, you would not inquire into the three aspects of the Lemon Test: valid secular purpose, primary effect, and excessive entanglement, and if you're going to apply a deferential standard of review, the one articulated under Turner.
What would you say the test is then? I'm not quite clear.
Well, the test under Turner, there's several factors. Uh-huh. One would be whether there's a valid rational connection between the prison program and legitimate governmental means, whether the governmental objective is in fact legitimate, whether prisoners have other outlets to express religious freedom. But
why doesn't that test trample on the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment? First Amendment Establishment Clause is designed to protect the societal interest in keeping government and religion from being entangled. The test that you've just described makes no allowance for the First Amendment.
Well, the distinction is one that I started to explain earlier. The governmental action in this case is allowing private religious choices. The action is not as broad as the plaintiffs would suggest that it is. The plaintiffs in this case are merely asserting a broad philosophical objection to the religious choices of the volunteers in the subject matter that they're teaching.
But
it's
not just a religious choice on the part of the volunteers, though. There's summary judgment evidence that it's the religious choice of the county employees who are making decisions about running the unit. Isn't that a big difference? I mean, how do you deal with that piece of it to avoid the entanglement problem and the endorsement problem under the Establishment Clause cases?
Well, the short answer is that shouldn't be the test. Any test that looks at entanglement and endorsement, those are different standards of review than the standard of review.
Okay, so if we were to reject your view that we look at Turner as providing the test and instead look at the Establishment Clause cases, then do you have a problem then?
No.
Why not? Given the question that Judge Baker asked about entanglement, why isn't there a problem on this record?
For instance, if Tarrant County, if Tarrant County's actions are judged under the Lemon Test, I think that it's clear that there is at least a valid secular purpose for operation of the CEU. The second prong of the Lemon Test is whether the primary effect of the unit advances religion. The summary judgment evidence all points towards the effect that it has on the inmate, the correctional effect of the program. And the respondents are...
And it gets there by advancing religion, correct?
The advancement of religion is incidental to that.
Well, why have it at all if it's only incidental? You could just put them in that unit and say, y'all are going to be better inmates than the other groups.
But the decision of what type of correctional program, faith-based or otherwise, is a decision that is properly reserved for the executive branch. Respectfully, running a prison is an inordinately difficult undertaking, and prison administrators are uniquely qualified to decide what types of innovative prison programs
achieve their correctional goals. Well, they are subject to constitutional limitations, though, even though they are qualified to run their particular...
There are constitutional limitations, and there are political limitations.
Any other questions?
Yeah, one more.
Well, it's just had 2 minutes.
Okay. How does your program pass the Lemon Test? If it's applied here, and the additional factors.
We discuss the valid secular purpose. Uh-huh. We discuss the evidence in the record about inmate effect. And with respect to the third prong, excessive entanglement, the use of volunteer chaplain to oversee the program and volunteers to actually teach avoids excessive entanglement. And that is the test. It's excessive, not any entanglement. And with regard to the second prong, the primary effect.
Well, is it a fair statement to say that the county officials enjoy complete authority over the program in its entirety?
They enjoy complete authority. They don't exercise complete authority, according to the facts on this
record. They may not exercise it, but they have it. Isn't that correct?
They do have it, Your Honor, but I would suggest that's irrelevant to the
determination. And then what about endorsement of a religion?
To focus on the religious aspect of any governmental action, to focus exclusively on the religion aspect of it, is going to result in a determination that it is an unconstitutional endorsement. Fortunately, that's not the test. And endorsement appears...
Well, you say that's not the test. What if we apply that test instead of Turner?
The endorsement test appears reserved for religious symbol cases when a municipality or a governmental entity erects or allows to be erected a religious symbol on governmental property.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Rohan and Mr. Pretty will present arguments for the respondent. Mr. Rohan will open for the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court, I'm Richard Rohan, and I'm here representing respondent and petitioner Ruth Marie Lara. Even though the entire discussion centered on the Establishment Clause, and I will get to that in a moment, I would like to just briefly make mention of one standing issue, because I suspect that it may get raised throughout the remainder of the argument. And it's a point that may be overlooked in the brief as not significant, but I can't stress its significance enough to Ms. Lara's position, and that is the claim that she has advanced under Section 1983. Under Section 1983, the basis upon which the Court of Appeals rejected that was through citing some cases in which prison guard incidents, and the court held that a conflagration between a prison guard and an inmate did not amount to a constitutional violation, and therefore threw out the Section 1983 claim on a liability basis. The reason why those cases are inapplicable here is that the Section 1983 is being advanced by Petitioner Lara to redress a violation of her constitutional right, particularly the right to be free of a governmental establishment of religion. The prison guard incident that the county alludes to and that the Court of Appeals relied on is in effect a red herring to whether there is a valid 1983 claim in this case. whether there had been no epithet shouted at my client by the prison guard, she would have standing to advance a 1983 claim based on government's establishment, the county's establishment of religion. 1983 cases are clear that one may recover mental anguish, non-physical, non-economic injury for 1983 violation. And more so, the cases are clear that even in the event that a jury were to determine that no actual injury was suffered, a prevailing claimant under Section 1983, if a violation of her constitutional right is established, is at a minimum entitled to recover nominal damages.
Well, let me ask you, according to Ms. Rowe's understanding of the Establishment Clause, it only applies to religious symbol cases. Do you have any cases where someone obtained 1983 damages in prosecuting a religious symbol case?
My understanding of Ms. Rowe's comment was that the endorsement test only applied to religious symbol cases. I thought I understood her to say that the endorsement test...
Well, that's part of the test of establishment. I'm just... In the establishment cases, she has focused on being religious symbol issues. Is there a case that says a citizen who prosecutes one of those claims is entitled to 1983 damages? My point being, societal interests in the establishment versus First Amendment speech interests that apply to individuals.
Well, I'm not aware of whether any cases reflect individuals trying to redress a public symbol case under Section 1983. However, there are many cases under which inmates have brought Establishment Clause challenges and also asserted Section 1983 claims as part of that. So I think the answer to the case that we have here before the court is that Section 1983 is available and has in fact been utilized as a means to redress a violation of the Establishment Clause.
So she was forced to participate in this program and that violated some right that she had, and she's entitled to 1983, or she didn't.
She was not forced to participate in the program. She was a member of the jail who was offended and stigmatized by the existence of the program.
Which was a religious symbol. She was offended by that religious symbol.
Well, I understood Ms. LaRoe, when talking about religious symbol cases, to be talking about creche cases, menorah cases, Christmas tree cases. I don't think that a governmental program, a county course of instruction on Christian living, would be traditionally categorized as a religious symbol case, as I understood that term to be used.
Maybe I'm not articulating very well. If I understand really Ms. Laura's case, it is because that program existed over there and offended me, I'm entitled to 1983. Now, it seems to me if Ms. LaRoe's argument is that that's simply an establishment issue. That's not a First Amendment freedom of religion question. I think if the jail prohibited Laura from attending whatever she wanted to do, that they were otherwise required to let her do under the right to participate in religion, then it seems to me there's a 1983 issue. But if you say, but the fact that it exists over there is simply a religious symbol case, can this individual say, well, I saw it over there and I was offended, I'm entitled to 1983?
Yes.
Do you have a case like that?
I can't cite you to the exact case. I believe that cases that have been cited in our brief are cases in which 1983 claims have been advanced. 1983 is just the vehicle by which someone whose federal constitutional rights have been violated may assert a claim, including a claim for damages. There's nothing magical to 1983 other than that is the vehicle, because it was unclear under the law as to whether a violation of the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution gave right to a direct action. So 1983 was the vehicle to assert the action. It should make no difference that it is an Establishment Clause claim of being offended by a religious program versus a free exercise claim of being denied free exercise of religion. 1983 is simply the vehicle, the jurisdictional, the statutory vehicle that enables a private citizen to make a claim for the violation of constitutional rights. And I don't think that the distinction between whether it's a symbol case or whether it was that this program is happening over here, it should be of any legal significance about the ability to assert 1983 as a basis for redress.
Mr. Rohan, Ms. Laura also takes a position that she has taxpayer standing in this case. What test should be applied to determine if she does have taxpayer standing?
The test should be applied as to whether there is a public expenditure of monies. And what's said in the two Texas Supreme Court cases cited, an illegal expenditure of public monies. That should be the only test.
But does she have a threshold, though, to say that she is a taxpayer before she can raise?
There's record evidence that she pays sales, that she has paid sales taxes. There is also record evidence that she was a renter. I would suggest that there would be no reasoned basis for the court to distinguish between one who rents property that indirectly flows to the payment of taxes as opposed to directly paying the taxes. I would
say that
for the purpose...
That's a little
dangerous, isn't it? Well, I think it would be at least as dangerous to draw that kind of a distinction. The purpose, I think, of taxpayer standing...
Well, with that type of argument, you have to get into the terms of the lease, whether it's net, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to be somewhat outside the scope of standing.
I would only say, well, I would say that the whole purpose of the invocation of the notion of taxpayer standing was to create a broadening of the ability of citizenry to redress certain grievances that might not otherwise be redressable.
And in that regard, the courts of appeals have been narrowing our old cases over the last generation, have they not? And has this court, in recent times, relied on taxpayer standing to hear a case?
It certainly is not something that comes up with great frequency.
Well, has it come up at all?
I can't give you the date and the side of the last case on which this court has granted standing based particularly on taxpayer standing. However, I would say...
The federal system does not recognize this type of broad standing for a constitutional challenge.
I'm sorry?
The federal system would not entertain a case on you paid sales tax so you can bring a constitutional challenge.
Actually, no, that's interesting. The federal law recognizes what is known as federal taxpayer standing, like Flass versus Cohen, which is brought under the tax. And there has to be a nexus, a linkage between the illegal expenditure and the tax and spend clause of the U.S. Constitution. However, the federal cases also recognize what they describe as state and municipal taxpayer standing. And there's actually been a federal law developed on the notion of state and municipal taxpayer standing. That doesn't necessarily mean cases brought in state court. It means that you're asserting taxpayer standing not as a federal taxpayer, but as a state or a municipal taxpayer. And the federal courts recognize a different burden of what needs to be shown for state and municipal taxpayer standing. And it is a lessened burden than what is needed to be shown as a federal taxpayer.
What is that burden?
The burden is only that there is an improper expenditure of public monies.
How direct must that expenditure be? An indirect expenditure? And how much? If you spend 5 cents?
I don't know that the cases have talked about a threshold level or de minimis standard, but here we have not only issues like the salary of the sheriff and the paid county chaplain, but the appropriation of monies to quadrant off one-fourth of a floor of the jail to house this. I would suggest that it's irrelevant that there's no incremental funds spent over what would need to be spent to house and feed them. You can't appropriate a sector of a floor and create a religious commune in that. And I think the Texas Constitution, Article 7, speaks to the idea of appropriating a governmental building for setting up a religious seminary. So a lot of money is being spent there. The question is more money being spent on the Xerox copies of the promotional material, the religious material? And I'll concede that if it's not, I would say it doesn't change the outcome. Now, I saw my light flashing for 10 minutes, and I...
I have one more question. Under the taxpayer, there are cases, and that's what the CA held in this case, that your client didn't show a special injury. And is that a requirement?
Well,
taxpayer standing?
I would have two answers to that. One is, the cases suggest that taxpayer standing is, in effect, an exception to, or is the special injury. Some cases have talked in that term. And then the other thing I would say, so that's how taxpayer standing deals with situations where someone doesn't have, if they had their own unique special injury, they wouldn't need to rely on taxpayer standing. So taxpayer standing steps in. But secondarily, in this case, Ms. Lara did have special injury. She was in the jail at the time when this program was created. And so certainly her situation differs from just a general member of society in that regard.
If we apply Turner, does your client lose?
No, the client does not, because under the first Turner factor, the governmental regulation has to be neutral. So even under the very first Turner factor, this program does not pass muster. Now, I would say that it is clear from looking at the cases that Turner is not the test in Establishment Clause case. The four factors don't fit, but this doesn't pass the first Turner factor.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, I'm Lawrence Pretty. I present an argument for Mr. Huff and Ron Flowers. I'd like first to address the Establishment Clause. The Court of Appeals opinion sets out the way that the jail operates, and it says that it's run closely by the sheriff and the chaplain, and they determine content. They don't allow anything to be taught other than conservative religious dogma. And I think that in itself eliminates any fact issues as whether or not this operates in violation of the Establishment Clause, because you can't do that, I don't believe, and not be in violation of the Establishment Clause.
Wasn't there evidence that in this particular unit it was safer than in the rest of the prison?
There are that advantage of this unit. It also probably does have rehabilitative value.
So it's safer. It provides greater rehabilitation than in the rest of the prison. And in fact, the other inmates would have preferred living in an environment similar to that which was in the unit as opposed to that which was outside the unit.
Some of them would and some of them wouldn't. Probably a lot of them would. It is a safer place.
So basically what you're saying is we shouldn't undertake activities like this which make life less chaotic and less organized. Instead, we should promote a system which creates more chaos, greater violence, and a poorer environment.
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm saying at all.
That's the result of what you're saying, isn't
it? I'm saying that they could run this, they probably could run this unit to where it would pass constitutional muster if they didn't involve themselves in determination of curricula and so forth. Because they do, that makes the way that they're running it unconstitutional.
Well, let me ask on that question. It seems to me, Ms. Rose, one of her points is if it's successful, then they've established that it has a penological advantage, and that's a factor that we ought to consider. So assuming that they're teaching, assuming that they even have the position that we're going to convert these inmates to Christianity, if that, in fact, produces a safer environment for the prisoners and a better control of the jail population, that's a reasonable, that's a rationally related factor or a basis for allowing the program to exist because it meets a significant penological interest.
I don't, that's Turner versus Safely, which I don't think is the correct thing to apply. Turner versus Safely is a limitation on free exercise. The free exercise cases that have to do with chaplaincy programs in the military and prison chaplaincies say that in those cases where the people don't have the ability to move around freely, the government may actually have to promote religion in order to meet their free exercise rights. But then there's a line of authority that comes up that limits that, and it says that we can't do that for everybody, and so if there's a legitimate penological interest in restricting it, it's going to be restricted to some extent.
What do you think would be constitutional if the sheriff and the chaplain merely reviewed the materials to make sure that they were not anti-Semitic, for example, or if they did not disparage other particular faiths? Would that be too much involvement?
That might be too much involvement. There's an interesting, the Doe versus Santa Fe case, which is a school prayer case, is going up on cert from the Fifth Circuit. And it involves the Lee versus Weissman test on how you, on review of school prayer, under the authorities used by the Fifth Circuit, the Clear Creek authorities, the school district has to review prayer. That's gone up. The petitioners in that case are asking for the Supreme Court to say that there's no limit on what you can do. It's far more likely they're going to reassert the Lee versus Weissman case and say you can't even review prayer.
So they can't review it to determine whether or not. Yeah. As Justice Abbott mentioned earlier, they're teaching the inmates how to escape from jail.
That may be, well, escape from jail is a completely different question from what kind of religion.
But certainly, still involving a review of the curriculum, what's there?
Certainly they could review it to that extent, but if they review it and say, well, your doctrine doesn't teach the Trinity and therefore we're not going to allow that, then that would be over the line, I think.
What is the evidence about the extent to which and the purpose for which they review the materials?
Well, when we filed this lawsuit, they were using some material that referred to Jehovah's Witness, Mormons, and even the Masons and other groups as cults. And when this lawsuit hit the newspaper, they pulled that. That's review.
Okay. What is the summary judgment evidence showing the purpose why they reviewed the materials?
Well, the sheriff, there's quotes from it in both briefs of the petitioners. The sheriff and the chaplain both said that they reviewed material in order to make sure that it was focused on the religious material that they wanted to cover. That is what we think is forbidden or not permitted.
What would a constitutional faith-based prison program look like?
What's that?
What would a constitutional faith-based prison program look like, since you say that this one is unconstitutional?
Well, in our case, Mr. Huff also has a free exercise case. His is a little different from Miss Lara's in that he asked for Jehovah's Witnesses to be allowed to come in and teach, and they wouldn't do it. Now, the Court of Appeals opinion said that was under Turner versus Safely on administrative convenience, but the buck slips, the slips that where he complained about it, say it was because the Jehovah's Witness teaching would be proselytizing.
Well, I understand, but I understand that you think that all of this is unconstitutional, but I'm asking you where the line gets drawn. What would a constitutional faith-based prison program look like?
I think that you would have to open it up to different points of view and allow different people to present their point of view. If you allowed all kinds of religious views in there, then that would be all right, I think, as long as you didn't determine the content. But, of course, the sheriff and the chaplain says that's counterproductive because we're trying to make these people into good Christians because it's not rehabilitative if we don't do that.
Well, what would be the role of the, in this instance, county employees in running that program and have it still be constitutional?
If they didn't meddle any with the content, then they would just simply provide administrative support and let people come in and out. I think they could do that. The summary judgment evidence clearly shows that they're not doing it.
What if they made the decision based on a track record? For example, a group comes in and they have a Christian program that has demonstrably lowered recidivism. But the Jehovah's Witness doesn't have that kind of track record. Would it be impermissible for the prison to decide, well, we're going to let this group come in and see how it works, but not some other group since they don't have a track record?
I continue to think that the correct test to apply as far as the Establishment Clause is concerned is the Lemon Test. And under that, they can pass the secular purpose by showing it does some good for the inmate. But it is where the primary purpose is to convert people to a religious point of view, and the chaplain is involved, and the sheriff as well, in determining content, then they violate the primary purpose and assesses the entanglement prongs of that test.
Can a prison have a Christian chaplain that tries to convert inmates to Christianity?
Actually, some of the chaplaincy cases say that the chaplain is not supposed to do that. In some of the cases in which chaplaincies have been held to be excessive, there was one, I can't remember which one it is, cited in the brief, maybe the Boss case, in which the chaplain was doing that, and he was fired and brought a lawsuit because he'd been fired for being excessive and proselytizing,
well,
and
prison,
his dismissal was upheld.
Can prison officials allow outside groups that are Christian-based groups come in for
sure.
the purpose of trying to convert?
Sure, and they allow people to do that on the Tuesday night services in this context, but again, there was some suggestion in meeting Mr. Huff's free exercise complaints that his preachers could
preach. Back to the Establishment Clause, would that violate the Establishment Clause, in your view, if you allow groups to come in on Tuesday night to attempt to convert prisoners?
If you allowed everybody to do it, but they don't let Jehovah's Witnesses or black Muslims or Jews, only these...
I'm talking about Establishment Clause.
For Establishment Clause, I think if it was open and you allowed everybody to do it, it would be all right. When you restrict it to one point of view, the fundamental Christian point of view, then that takes it over the line.
Well, let me get a quick reference to the record. Can you tell me where I can find that the primary purpose of this program was to convert inmates to Christianity?
I don't think it says that directly, except that there are several places that the chaplain Atwell and the sheriff are quoted as saying that they anything other than that would be counterproductive, and that they monitor content to make sure that that's how it's focused. And that is what I think. I haven't
any other questions. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Fremont will present the rebuttal of the petitions.
Good morning. A couple of points that are evident throughout the argument in this case are, one, that we're talking about a jail. It's the jail that we're talking about. This is a unique environment, and it's also catcalled. The plaintiffs essentially ignore the catcalled case in this case, in this particular case, and it's an identical situation. What the federal court said in catcalled was, you take these people out of the community. You take them away from their ability to exercise their religious freedom, and you have to then accommodate that in some way. The court said that in the Katkoff case that Congress could permit a funding of a military chaplaincy program, and that the free exercise clause makes the Lemon versus Kurtzman test inappropriate in that particular situation. The court also talked about jail administrators. Neither the Establishment Clause or the Chaplaincy Program can be evaluated in a sterile environment. There's a need for flexibility. The rigidity could well defeat...
But those chaplaincy cases do not allow the endorsement of a particular religion. Isn't that correct? Isn't that still a limit that is put
yes.
on those cases?
Yes, Justice.
So, I mean, it can't be used the money so that you can hire someone who is a chaplain who will promote or endorse a particular religion.
That's correct.
Well, why then are those cases applicable here if we have a decision being made to promote a particular religious belief?
Justice Hankinson, I think the summary judgment evidence, which has been discussed some this morning, shows that there is no intent to endorse. Much of the evidence in the record is about the personal beliefs of Chaplain Atwell or Sheriff Williams. What do you believe? They were grilled and questioned on that in minute detail. That is a separate issue, apart from how is the chaplain's education unit to be run. There is no endorsement. There is an accommodation. There is the intent to achieve the secular purpose of reducing violence, have the inmates studying, reading, obviously, whether it rehabilitates or not.
Well, since you take the position that this program does not violate the Establishment Clause, what type of prison ministry program would violate the Establishment Clause? If you're telling us to draw the line someplace else, where would we draw it?
I think the faith-based program has a place. It is not going to violate the Establishment Clause if it's conducted properly. And the parameters of that type of program are those that, in effect, the county, the Sheriff's Department, has attempted to accomplish or achieve in this particular case.
No, but I want to know, when there must be a point in time where the county could cross over the line and violate the Establishment Clause.
For example, if everyone were required to endorse Christianity,
yes,
you would agree that would cross the line?
Sure.
If it were involuntary, that would cross the line?
Sure.
I think the endorsement is obviously a threshold beyond which we cannot go, and there's obviously going to be a common sense, reasonable decision that has to be made with regard.
I just want to know what one of these programs looks like that would be unconstitutional. Obviously, I mean, coercion is not a requirement under an Establishment Clause case to show a violation, but it can be evidence that there is an Establishment Clause problem. We have one set of parties here who's complaining that this crosses over the line because the employees of the county are involved in determining the content of the program, and in fact it advocates a particular religious viewpoint. You say this doesn't cross over the line, and my question is, it seems to me that where do you draw the line where it crosses over the line, since you don't agree with them that this is one of those cases?
Well, I think if the plaintiffs are correct, if there is an endorsement of a religion, if there is an official endorsement to the exclusion of other faiths, then there would be. But we don't have that in this case, and the evidence doesn't support that. A close reading of the evidence will show that this is not a perfect system because people are involved in it. There's going to be decisions. Just as if the policy of the county were not to allow correctional officers to engage in excessive force, that doesn't mean there's never going to be an incident of excessive force. It just means that there is no policy that permits that.
How could you set up and administer one of these programs in a way that would violate the Establishment Clause? Where should we draw the line?
I think if the policy, be it written or be it implicit, says that we favor a particular faith or religion, if that can be gleaned from the facts of the situation, then that would be impermissible.
What about the exhibit that shows Chaplain Athey's memo to Chief Swanson that says we're going to teach practical Christian living. We're going to teach Christian character and use the Bible only. We're going to teach Philippians and use the Bible only. Practical Christian living.
This is one of those cases.
Well, I think if the plaintiffs are correct, if there is an endorsement of a religion, if there is an official endorsement to the exclusion of other faiths, then there would be. But we don't have that in this case, and the evidence doesn't support that. A close reading of the evidence will show that this is not a perfect system because people are involved in it. There's going to be decisions. Just as if the policy of the county were not to allow correctional officers to engage in excessive force, that doesn't mean there's never going to be an incident of excessive force. It just means that there is no policy that permits that.
How could you set up and administer one of these programs in a way that would violate the Establishment Clause? Where should we draw the line?
I think if the policy, be it written or be it implicit, says that we favor a particular faith or religion, if that can be gleaned from the facts of the situation, then that would be impermissible.
What about the exhibit that shows Chaplain Athey's memo to Chief Swanson that says we're going to teach practical Christian living. We're going to teach Christian character and use the Bible only. We're going to teach Philippians and use the Bible only. Practical Christian living. Teach 1 John. Isn't that at least an inference of an endorsement of only one faith?
Justice Baker, that's a good point. In the distinction there to be made,
how can that not be an endorsement of a religion?
It's not an endorsement because the chaplain's education unit, there was only one. No one ever asked or wanted to set up another one. There was no one coming forward and wanting to set up another religious education unit.
But do we need to be worried about that when we're only looking at the one that they actually set up and implemented?
Because it was voluntary, inmates coming into this chaplain's education unit expected to be able to worship. They were Christians. This was, if you will, a truth in advertising effort that people coming into this particular unit would receive that faith with those tenants. So it's to really protect the inmates so that they don't get some other brand of religion, some other brand of Christianity than what would normally be, and much has been made of the term orthodox, and all kinds of things have been implied and read into that. But what orthodox means is established, traditional, basic. It doesn't mean fundamentalist. It doesn't mean conservative. It means non-divisive, non-controversial, well-accepted principles that all Christian inmates who volunteered for this particular unit could agree with and live with, if you will, and wouldn't be offended by it when they found themselves in the chaplain's education.
Well, I've read your argument then, or understand it to mean that because the people who were actually admitted as volunteers adhered to the curriculum that was established, that there can't be a constitutional violation of the program itself because everybody there was a Christian.
If I understand your question, Justice Baker, I think that's correct.
That's what you're advocating.
Yes.
Could you speak to standing in the closing minutes?
I will try to.
1983 and
Texas. I will try to, Justice Phillips. With regard to the standing issue, as has been mentioned earlier, the federal courts have basically put up a pretty rigid standard for that. And it is essentially that in federal cases, if the inmate is gone from the prison, they no longer have standing or the issue becomes moot. Those are somewhat interrelated. In this particular case, this lawsuit was filed in July of 1993. These particular plaintiffs, inmates Laura and Huff, were moved out of the jail to the Texas Department of Corrections in October of 1993. So they were there only a very short time. They may have had standing while they were there. The Court of Appeals said, well, the sheriff could move these inmates anytime he or she wanted to and eliminate the lawsuit. Well, as we know, that's really not the way inmates go to TDC. The sheriff doesn't have the decision to move inmates to prevent them from litigating. The other issue is, as far as the taxpayer standing, if we expand that definition of taxpayer standing to include sales tax or indirect payment of rent, the exception is just going to consume the rule. Additionally, in this particular case, these inmates, if you want to analogize and say, well, the courts have done away with requirement for poll tax and various things that preclude people from access to their government or constitutional rights. In this particular case, not only were these inmates not taxpayers, not only could they not show a injury that would rise to a constitutional level, they weren't even entitled to vote. They were convicted felons, and the record shows that.
What about for Mr. Flowers?
Well, there again, Justice Abbott, I think the record shows that Dr. Flowers had no different injury than any other taxpayer. Additionally, if the chaplain's education unit were shut down tomorrow, there would be no less money being spent.
That seems to have kind of gone beyond the scope of the question. Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the argument and the first call, since the court will take a brief recess.